Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Donald Trump says he never thought he made that promise to keep more than 1,000 carrier corporation jobs in Indiana that were slated to move to Mexico. And also, the union leader who heard him make it is terrible at his job. Shown the video in which he made the promise, Trump explained he didn't mean it quite that way. Okay, but what if instead of getting lost in Trump's machinations, media looked at what deals like the one that actually happened with Carrier actually wind up meaning for workers and local economies? We'll hear from Greg LeRoy from the group Good Jobs First about what reporters interested in jobs rather than in what Trump says today about jobs could be talking about now. Also on the show, the announcement that the Army Corps of Engineers would not grant a permit for the last part of the Dakota Access Pipeline was cause for celebration, not just among the indigenous water protectors at Standing Rock, but for all of those in solidarity with the historic human and environmental struggle that No Dapple has come to represent. As we look for lessons from the Standing Rock fight, first among them has to be that it isn't over. We'll talk about the importance of what happens now with writer, organizer, and photographer Kelly Hayes. That's coming up, but first we'll take a very quick look back at recent press. Corporate media have a lot on their plate between ferreting out Russian operatives and deciding whether to write that Trump broke promises he doesn't remember making. Still, there are some easy calls. Like when a president-elect runs a company that owes millions to a bank that is currently in negotiations with the Justice Department, that's not, as one headline had it, a business tangle. It's a clear-cut conflict of interest. And so you don't need to write, as the New York Times did, that such connections mean Donald Trump will remain vulnerable to charges that he has conflicts, but simply that he has them. As Dean Baker explained on Fair.org, Trump's business conflicts are not adequately captured in the Times' Andrew Ross Sorkin's rendering as a conundrum, so much as a constitutional violation. The same constitution that says you can't be president unless you're 35 years old says you can't be president if you take payments from foreign governments. Not that it's okay as long as you agree to schemes like that Sorkin floats in a November 28th piece that not only presents Trump's conflicts as something he doesn't have to do anything about, but should, but also says it could all be answered with Trump voluntarily agreeing to a corporate monitor who would provide reports to the public about possible conflicts. Would this be the same Trump, Baker wonders, as the one who won't release his tax returns, who's going to report voluntarily about his potential conflicts to a monitor, who will then tell the public what it thinks we need to know? Every other president in the last 50 years has put any assets in a blind trust. It's not really confusing, but people could be confused, especially if media make it their business to confuse them. And corporate media reported the mistrial in the case of South Carolina police officer Michael Slager, who video showed shooting unarmed African-American Walter Scott, whom he'd stopped for a broken tail light, 8 times in the back in April 2015 as Scott ran away from him, then handcuffing him on the ground and dropping a taser alongside his body. Mostly there were dry headlines like, "Mistrial declared in black driver's death." NAP piece got the headline that many were at a loss at the outcome. Other headlines on the same piece had folks stunned. Well, that AP story itself included comments that started to get at the depths of despair. A jury full of people and they can't decide if it's illegal to shoot someone who is running away from you? Asked one source. What do you say about a country that feels this way about black people? Do we really have anything that can seriously be called the administration of criminal justice? Asks another. Well, indeed. corporate media keep referring in passing to how the country has been rocked or staggered by revelations of police brutality in black communities, evoking the question, if we were really staggered, wouldn't something like this knock us over? Instead, we got only media gestures toward the documented research showing how hard it is to convict police officers, especially when they kill black and brown people, and bland references to racial tensions. The Daily News was the only paper I found editorializing on the mistrial. Under the headline, "Believe Your Eyes," the paper noted that they don't generally weigh in on questions of guilt, but that measured against the video evidence, Slager's testimony that he was gripped by total fear and fired until the threat was stopped, as I was trained to do, can only be described as emanating from a parallel universe. The New York Times ran an editorial on Walter Scott's killing last April, saying that the quick charging of Michael Slager was encouraging, along with FBI and Justice Department involvement. Such wrongful deaths, the Times said, present a clear danger to the civic fabric. The country needs to confront this issue directly and get this problem under control. The paper's editorial silence on the mistrial highlights the all-important gap between the relative ease of calling for change and the difficulty of examining why it doesn't come. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. There are many questions to be asked about Trump's deal with Carrier Corporation's Indiana plant. How many jobs did it actually save? What exactly did he offer carrier parent United Technologies, much less why he sought the deal in the first place and whether he himself remembers? But while an argument in which Sarah Palin comes out against Trump's crony capitalism is somewhat dazzling, our guest suggests we keep our eyes on the substantive issue being unearthed here, namely corporations' ability to use jobs, aka workers' livelihoods, to extort favorable deals from the state, deals that can wind up hurting the communities that those workers live in. Greg LeRoy is executive director of Good Jobs First. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Greg LeRoy.
Thanks, Jeanine. Great to be with you.
Well, I remember Kate Bronfenbrenner from Cornell showing how employers used threats of plant closings in 50% of union organizing drives. One company posted maps of North America throughout the factory with a big arrow from the current plant site to Mexico. That was the mid-1990s.
Right.
So the idea that Trump's deal with Carrier will give other companies ideas doesn't really make too much sense, does it? There's a history here.
Yeah, that's right. Lots of companies have been threatening to move to Mexico for a long time, even before NAFTA. I worked on my first runaway shop to Mexico in 1986, a windshield wiper plant in Buffalo called Trico. Not new and not unique to this time or this recession. It's important to remember all state and local taxes combined as a cost of doing business for the average company in this country come to just 2% of their cost structure. The carrier subsidies, the $7 million that Indiana gave Carrier, isn't the cause for them staying. In fact, it's ludicrous. The company was on record saying they'd save $65 million a year and they're going to get $700,000 a year for 10 years from the state for moving. It can't be the reason they decided to stay. It must be about the defense contracts.
Right, the defense contracts that their parent company, United, is involved in. And that's part of the kind of turn over the stone and look at the specifics of this carrier deal. But what I want to talk to you about is the fact of the ability of corporations to do this. It's not only about moving to Mexico. A lot of what the history is about what you pointed out Business Week called the second war between the states, you know,
yes,
back in 1976. It's really about back and forth between states.
That's right. It's all too easy for a company to go have lunch with the mayor of Greenwich, Connecticut, or the mayor of Jersey City, New Jersey, and create the appearance of looking like you're interested in running, you know, across the Hudson. and then shake down New York City to stay. We listed in a book I wrote 11 years ago dozens of financial services companies, banks, media companies, stock exchanges who did this and then got, you know, 8- and 9-figure retention packages, so to speak, from the city.
Part of the problem is that we don't see it happening. You know, reporters are purporting to talk about what the quid pro quos are, but the fact is they're not actually aware of all of them necessarily. You described that corporate decision making as a black box. Nobody gets to really see that deal making, even though we're all implicated.
That's exactly right. We are all implicated because it's all money coming out of our collective public treasuries that is needed for schools and infrastructure and police and fire and sanitation and everything else that we do with those taxes. But you're right. It is a black box. At the end of the day, we're forced to accept whatever the companies say. And the script is that you get the tax break and then you praise the politician that gave it to you so that they can get reelected. So they, especially during this long, painful recovery, they can look like they're being aggressive on jobs.
Well, I think it's confusing for a lot of folks watching the media, certainly for their understanding of this, because I think folks are going to come away thinking that to criticize this carrier deal is to be anti-worker, you know, because after all, some jobs were saved and we're supposed to be thankful for any handful of jobs that were saved in the U.S. And I worry that the conversation is so unsubtle, you know, that we can't actually see a broader thing in play. And I wonder if you could just talk to us a little bit about the difference between jobs were saved and something was done that actually would improve the world for U.S. workers.
Yeah, great point. So the journalism on this issue has been all over the map, this episode of Carrier. Obviously, Trump got a ton of favorable coverage, and it's reflected in a poll that suggests a very high approval rating for what he did. To their credit, a few journalists that I can think of have said, wait a minute, let's look up this thing called trade adjustment assistance, which is the certification of other plants that are closing because of runaway shops or import competition, even just for the state of Indiana. And the truth is there's dozens of other cases in any given moment of companies running off to Mexico or China or other places that aren't going to get Trump's attention. And nothing he did at Carrier was any kind of systemic, you know, silver bullet for all of those people. So he can't sit there and do one-offs all the time, and not every company running away to Mexico is going to have another division that depends on Pentagon contracts that he can make noise about. There's no systemic solution here. The Indianapolis Star, a guy named Tony Cook, did a fabulous job both before and since pointing out that as governor, Pence had given subsidies to several companies that had offshored, for example. That had come out last summer in the Indianapolis Star. Great series.
Right. I hate to see journalists giving their time just to picking off instances of hypocrisy here, because I think folks are really actually looking for a deeper understanding of processes and how things work, no matter who's in charge, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I want to go to what sounds very uninteresting and yet is potentially very interesting indeed, which is Government Accountability Standards Board statement number 77.
Now we're entering serious wonky land. So there's this obscure body up in Connecticut called the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. It's a, despite its name, not a public body. It's a nonprofit sort of standard-setting group. It sets forth what are called Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, or GAAP, with two A's, for state and local government bodies. And the rationale here is that everybody should keep their books in a uniform way so that the credit rating agencies can give you the best possible credit rating and you can get the lowest possible interest rate if you have to float bonds, you know, to build a new school or sewer system or whatever. So GASB's been around for a long time. It's been around since the 80s, and it periodically updates the wording of GAAP in statements. And one of the most recent statements it issued is number 77, where they actually finally got around to corporate welfare. They said, starting for calendar 2017 and beyond, when you issue this thing called your Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, your CAFR, for the previous year, the year the spending that you're reporting on that you just finished, you're going to have to account for how much revenue you lost to these economic development tax break programs, so-called tax abatements. This is big tectonic shift in policy. First time they've ever touched any kind of tax breaks of any kind. And we know that more than 50,000 bodies of state and local government will do this because they comply with GAAP. And we think tens of billions of dollars are going to be dragged out of the shadows. School districts and counties and cities and townships, as well as multiple layers of state government, will all have this data coming out next year. So we think this whole debate about corporate tax breaks next year is going to get really, really amped up, because at the same time, Trump is going to be cutting federal aid to cities and federal aid to schools and so on. All this new data is going to come out pointing out how much money is getting lost to corporate tax breaks. The two things are going to be colliding next year.
And I think they're going to be colliding also with more eyes on them, because folks are, for varying reasons, looking down to state and local levels for, you know, political conversation, for political action. So the fact that that's coming out at that level. But I do just want to underscore that this is connected with the jobs conversation, in the sense that states often do a kind of chicanery with jobs going across borders. And that's related to this statement 77 that we're talking about.
Well, it is, because although it's still legal for companies to jump state lines and have their jobs defined as new, quote, unquote, as they arrive in a state, maybe even though they just moved, you know, down the block in the case of Kansas City, or across the city line in the case of Memphis into Mississippi or wherever, this new data, we think, is going to really make it much easier for citizen activists to hold their elected officials accountable and say, wait a minute, what's going on with all this money? We didn't know it was that much. Our schools are in trouble or whatever. We've got better things to do with this money. And frankly, there's even a right conversation on this, right? You've got groups like Americans for Prosperity going after film production tax credits in some states. You know, it's a left-right kumbaya, frankly, on this transparency stuff.
Well, let me just ask you finally on the carrier deal itself. What would you hope that folks would have as a takeaway from it? We know that media tend to get kind of confused in the frippery sometimes, but what do you think is the core here?
Well, I think the core story is this was a one-off, but it raises the broader issue of what are states really doing if they're serious about retaining jobs and not wasting any more money as they try to do it. There are tangible solutions. We can fix this. We can stop committing interstate job fraud. We can stop pulling wool over people's eyes and be honest about how jobs are created.
We've been speaking with Greg LeRoy of Good Jobs First. Find their work online at goodjobsfirst.org. Greg LeRoy, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin. The struggle of the Standing Rock Sioux against the completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline rivets the attention of people around the world, not only as an environmental story, an emblem of what the fight to address climate change actually looks like, but also as an historic story, a chapter in the resistance of indigenous people to the violent power of state and corporate actors. The announcement that the Army Corps of Engineers would withhold an easement permit for the last part of the Dakota Access Pipeline, pending an environmental impact study, is a significant moment that should nonetheless not be mistaken for the end of either that environmental or that historical story. Joining us to talk about where we're at is Kelly Hayes, a direct action trainer and a co-founder of the Chicago Light Brigade and the direct action collective Lifted Voices. She's also community relations associate and a contributing writer at Truthout. She joins us by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Kelly Hayes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, acknowledging and celebrating activist victories is psychically necessary, for one, and also important in terms of seeing what works. It's also true that precisely because we want to derive meaningful lessons, we have to put gains in context. And I would say that's not discouraging, but actually a way to ward off discouragement, because these fights that we're in are long haul fights. So what shall we celebrate now in the No DAPL fight? And what do you think we should be mindful of as the context for that celebration?
Well, I was saying to some folks in a direct action workshop just the other day that we have to understand victory as coming in stages, always. But as storytellers, we have to recognize that our victories are not just climactic, you know, in the way that an outside view might understand them. just having a group of people who are willing to throw down and take things to the next level so that we can all be free and so that our people may live. That's kind of what I would call a stage one victory. And we've obviously come way beyond that with the Standing Rock struggle. Our people have been throwing down for 8 months now. A number of my friends have been staying out there and have made a home there for more than 5 months on end. Some of my friends are actually day one individuals. And for them, of course, it's huge. It's hard to overstate how emotionally powerful it is to know that oil was going to be pumping through that pipeline by January 1st. That was something that Energy Transfer Partners had promised its investors, that there would be oil in that pipeline by January 1st, and there won't be. So missing that deadline creates a point of weakness that can be exploited, that can be dug into deeper by those of us who want to make sure this pipeline never happens. But it's very, very important that we don't let our desire for a happy ending give this recent development any kind of notion of finality, because there is no finality here. If anything, the only thing that was maybe finitely accomplished here was that the Obama administration came up with a maneuver that will remove this as a stain from the legacy of an outgoing president. It will now be on Trump's watch. But that's the problem for us, right, is that Donald Trump is about to take office, and he's already stated that the moment he's in office, all of this gets reevaluated. And we have heard from experts that it would be a matter of hours if Trump were determined to do so for him to dismantle these gains that we have recently made. So it's important for us always to find joy and to celebrate each other and to celebrate how far we've come and to celebrate the losses of our opponents. But we are at a very critical time, and mischaracterizing this as the larger battle being won risks us falling from the headlines, risks this entire story being pushed out of public view. It took a whole lot of fighting. It took a whole lot of people getting hurt and really living this struggle in order for this to be seen. So we're at a critical juncture in terms of making sure that this does not become unseen, that it does not lose the attention that it's gained. And we're also at a critical juncture in terms of where we direct our resistance now. The truth is they are more vulnerable now than they have ever been in terms of money getting shut off. We have one bank that's already disinvested. We have Wells Fargo sending out letters to people who have objected, saying that they're willing to sit down with our elders and our leaders. We have millions of dollars that have been moved already through Move Your Money campaigns to get people to divest from banks that are supporting the pipeline. We need to hit on that front harder than ever. We need people to disrupt their banks. We need people to shut down banks that are funding this pipeline. We need people to move their money and make sure that their financial institutions know exactly why they're moving their money. This is where we have the most power now, and that's actually a really beautiful thing, because people can do this from wherever they are. Like, we don't need to be able to get to Standing Rock in order to be a part of the front line, you know, as we think about it, because we can create front lines in cities around the country. There is a front line waiting to be created outside of every Wells Fargo, outside of every Chase Bank, and we can all be doing this, but we need to see this as a moment of expansion in this struggle and not a moment of resolution.
Well, I just want to say that you went right to where I was hoping for, because I think it's easy to make fun of, you know, but activism by unpracticed activists, people who aren't organizers, but are, you know, bartenders and teachers and retail workers, but who are frightened and angry and concerned, that activism is important, you know, and people are asking, what can I do from home, you know? And I just think that rather than snipe about what's the best kind of resistance, I think talking about what people can do seems worthwhile, because each specific fight that we're in is going to be, as you might say, more optional for some folks than for others. But it's important that people see the connections between those various fights.
Oh, absolutely. And I think something that's been very heartening for a lot of people about No DAPL is the connectivity. that this has created the potential for, the connectivity that it's established. Here in Chicago, we have gone after banks a few times now, and a coalition that has formed around doing so involves my group, Lifted Voices, which is a, you know, a direct action-oriented group, but also largely we do a lot of direct action education. So folks who are already kind of on that radical tip, we have the American Indian Center, which has been largely a cultural hub and direct services hub in the city, working hand-in-hand with us, people like the Autonomous Tenants Association. It's just broadening and broadening, and now we're actually having conversations here in town about how do we connect prison divestment, private prison divestment, with no DAPL divestment. How do we tell that story in a more connected way? So building these interconnections between movements being essential, and absolutely, as you were saying, we need to have a lot of healthy regard for all these folks who maybe haven't been doing this, maybe have never done any of this. Anyone who wants to be elitist about activism is really shooting themselves in the foot, both feet, really, because without new folks being activated, where are we going? I want a movement, not a clubhouse of people who think they know how it works. I want people to understand that organizing means messing up. In addition to doing great things and changing the world, and we will do great things and we will change the world, we're going to mess up. So when I invite somebody to join me in direct action, to join me in organizing, I'm inviting them to make mistakes as well, because there is no science to getting free that is a proven formula, or we would all be safe and free by now. So I welcome and invite and I celebrate people to whom this is all very new, doing whatever they can from wherever they can, and knowing that it's going to be bumpy and maybe even silly sometimes, but that this is how we're going to all evolve forward together.
We've been speaking with writer, social justice organizer, and photographer Kelly Hayes. You can find her work on No DAPL and other issues as well on truthout.org. Kelly Hayes, thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.